was coming in hot.
Members, the committee will come to order this morning. Welcome one and all for today's telecom. We have a very good presentation today for our agenda. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. See, do we have a quorum? We do have a quorum. Representative Saylor moves the minutes, I do believe.
Saylor moves the minutes.
Yes, thank you.
Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Let's move on then with today's presentation from Mr. Geller, if he's still here. Well, there he is. Come on down and tell us about who you are, who you represent, and go ahead.
Sure. Good morning, Chairman Johnson, members of the committee. My name is Jack Geller. I'm president of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. For those who don't know, the center was created 10 years ago this year in 1997 by the Minnesota State Legislature, basically for the purpose of collecting data, information, and being a resource to policymakers about what's going on in rural Minnesota. Back in 1999, very early on in our organization's life, I happened to be at the Humphrey Institute at a meeting, and people were talking about telecommunications, and I asked a number of people at that time, well, what do you think of rural telecommunications, rural broadband? Where do you think it's going? And uniformly I was told, gee, I really haven't thought about it very much. And so at that point in time, I guess on my drive back to southern Minnesota, I kept on thinking, that's something we're going to pay attention to, and that's something we're going to put on our screen. And as far as I know, and I could see that there's quite a few telecommunication experts in the room, we're the only organization in Minnesota that's been annually monitoring the adoption of this kind of technology, the diffusion of this technology throughout rural Minnesota year after year after year after year. So what I'm going to try to do today is basically run you through our latest survey results. When I say late, this is latest. This is really hot off the presses. This is data that was collected in December 2006 and a little bit of January 2007. So early, as Representative Junkie knows, we haven't written the report yet. So we've analyzed the data. We put together some slides. And the best I can do is the copies of the slides that you have. But we will have a full-blown report on this study probably within 30 to 45 days from now. The other thing I'm going to try to do is put it in the context that broadband is not unique. It's an innovation. It's a new technology. And the way broadband is being adopted, both in rural and metro areas, is very consistent with the way all new innovations are adopted. It doesn't matter whether you're looking at the diffusion of cell phones throughout a society. It doesn't matter whether you're looking at the diffusion of microwave ovens in our kitchens. You know, new technology develops, and there are people who've been studying the adoption and diffusion of innovations for decades now, going back to farmers adopting hybrid corn back in the 40s. And quite frankly, it's a well-worn path that broadband is not all that unique. The other thing I'll try to talk about is look at the factors that are encouraging and discouraging people from adopting broadband, and some of the new applications and the factors that are really just now, over the past year and a half, 2 years, I would argue, is really driving demand in a way that we really haven't seen before. As I said, people have been studying this for a while. Anybody who's taken a communications course has seen this typical S-curve. Basically, it just shows over time that any new innovation, a small percentage of the population starts adopting it. At some point, you hit a critical mass, some might call a tipping point, and you really see the diffusion and the adoption of an innovation really take off. Some might argue that once around 25-30% of the population adopts this new technology, that really starts driving the curve almost straight up. But as you notice, as you get towards the top of the curve, it starts leveling out. And the bottom line is that there is no technology in our society that is completely ubiquitous. There's always going to be people, for a variety of reasons, who do not adopt a new technology. We all probably have, grandmas who, for whatever reason, have yet to put a microwave oven in their kitchen, and they're not going to. Or we all have friends who, even though it's 2007, still don't have a cell phone or other kind of personal communication device. This is the nature of technology adoption. So the fact that your neighbor may say, broadband, it's not for me, well, he might be right. It just may not be for him, and there's no reason to get too terribly upset about it. This next slide looks at that S-curve in a different way, and this is based upon a guy named Everett Rogers, who started his career at Iowa State and ended his career at Stanford University. And basically, he looks at that S-curve, and he puts it in a kind of bell shape, and really talks about the types of people who are adopting and the characteristics of people who adopt technology, and basically says the first 2.5% of people who adopt any kind of new technology, new innovation, are really innovators. They're risk takers. This is experimental technology. Nobody knows whether or not it's really going to be beneficial, but it's kind of high risk, high reward. They're clearly well ahead of the curve. Shortly behind them are people who are early adopters, and Rogers argues that they are risk takers as well, but not as risky, if you will, as innovators are. And once you get about 15% of the population adopting a technology, he would argue that you move into what he calls the early majority. And somewhere, as you can see, when you get to around that 30% mark, so about halfway through the early adopters, the curve really starts going up remarkably. And I'm going to argue a little bit later in this presentation that that's almost precisely where we are right now. Also, as we get to the backside of the curve, and I don't think it's meant to be a denigrating term or whatnot, but he calls the last 16% of people who adopt technology laggards. These are people who are very risk averse. They need to be absolutely certain that this technology is going to be, if they can't absolutely convince themselves that this is a benefit to them, they're just not interested in adopting it. And early on, when people were looking at, for example, the adoption of new hybrid seed corn, which was back in the 40s, as opposed to varietal corn, you really had to wait years and years and years to look over that fence row at your neighbor's farm and be absolutely convinced that this guy's getting better yields. This is a better technology. And finally, the last of the last people who are going to adopt finally do. So let's talk about, within that context, technology adoption in Minnesota. Basically, what we do is we look at three major sets of questions, and they fall in a logical order. The first one is, do you have a computer in your home? It's very simple. It all starts with a computer. No computer, no internet. No internet, no broadband. So we have to look and see, do you have a computer in your home? And the three categories, the three geographies we looked at, we labeled the metro area, which basically represents the 7-county metro. Then we have Greater Minnesota, which represents the other 80 counties. And then we have a new category that we threw in this year called Rural Minnesota. And the reason why we have a separate category for Rural Minnesota as opposed to Greater Minnesota is because within Greater Minnesota, you have Rochester, St. Cloud, and Duluth. And the truth is these three areas actually look a lot more like the metro area in their technology adoption than the rest of rural Minnesota. So what we did is we separated out those three areas and then saw what the adoption rates looked like.
Dr. Geller?
Yes.
Just a brief question. What would your definition of broadband be as you move forward in this discussion?
Right. And that's a very good question, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in detail later on. But basically, broadband is an always-on connection basically it's not a dial-up connection. It's an always-on connection. And according to the FCC, it's at 200 kilobits per second or higher. But the truth of the matter is there are very few, if any, providers in Minnesota that are offering speeds that low. You know, most are starting at 256 or 384. And so clearly we call that broadband. One of the problems we have with our study is that a lot of people really don't know what their connection speeds are. They just know, in their minds, it's fast and it's broadband. And so when you try to kind of massage the data, it starts getting a little bit unreliable because you have to make certain assumptions that people really know what their connection speeds are. And I would argue that right now, for those who are connected to the Internet, you probably don't know what your connection speed is right now either. And so basically we make fairly broad distinctions. If you have a dial-up connection, you know you have a dial-up connection. And if you have an always-on connection, you know that. But whether or not at any point in time you're running it anywhere between 384K or 6 megs per second, you may have a neighborhood idea, but you really don't know that well.
So it's not dial-up connection.
Right, exactly. And it doesn't matter whether it's provided by a cable company, whether it's provided by a telephone company, whether it's provided by a satellite service or a fixed wireless provider. From the user standpoint of always on, it seems to be the same. The other thing that you might be interested in is that people are very confused about the labels of technology. And so it's just like if I said, you know, pass me a Kleenex, you would know what I'm talking about. But you would also know I'm not really asking for a Kleenex brand tissue. I'm really saying pass me a tissue. And we use the word Kleenex as if it is, you know, a generic term for a tissue. But it really isn't. It's a particular brand of tissue. Well, DSL is kind of taking on that quality. And so you say, what kind of connection you have? People say, I got DSL. And you say, well, who do you get it from? And they say, well, I get it from Time Warner. Well, Time Warner is a cable company, and they don't have DSL. And DSL is taking on that kind of generic term for high-speed Internet. And so that also is a problematic issue for people who do these kinds of surveys. So over the past couple of years, we've been asking them what kind of technology they have, and then we also ask them who their provider is to try to differentiate whether they really understand the technology they have. This particular slide really looks at computer ownership, internet connectivity, and then broadband adoption in those three geographies. And as you can see, the metro area, which is characterized in the blue, has always, from the time we started doing this, outpaced both Greater Minnesota and Rural Minnesota. And what you'll see throughout this presentation is that a lot of it is driven by computer ownership, because it really starts there. And so once you understand that the penetration of computers is somewhat the ceiling for the penetration of broadband, at least for right now, I mean, there could be some day when the primary appliance to connect, you know, for broadband or an internet is no longer a computer. And right now, to be honest, a computer is a rather intimidating appliance to go on the internet. It's really designed for multiple functions. And it's not a very good technology and a good appliance for our internet connection, but it is the appliance for today and, as best I can tell, tomorrow. So right now, when you're talking about home broadband, home internet connectivity, you have to understand that the ceiling for the potential of the diffusion is really tied to computer ownership in the home. So this really basically shows that as of right now, 71% of homes in the metro area have a home computer. That's 67% for Greater Minnesota. I'm sorry, 59% for Great. I'm sorry again, 65% for Greater Minnesota and 63% for rural Minnesota. And it all follows down, internet connectivity and broadband adoption. And as you can see, there are some very significant differences between broadband adoption rates in the metro area at 57% now, compared to 37% in Greater Minnesota, in rural Minnesota, which is essentially, as I said, the other 80 counties, exit Duluth, exit St. Cloud, exit Rochester.
Representative Saylor, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to you. I just was going back to that other slide because I didn't see it mentioned in forward slides, and that is on that difference, you know, with the broadband, why you just mentioned that there's such a difference. Do you think that's because people are choosing not to adopt or because it simply isn't available? Do you have any data on that?
Yeah, and I will show you data on that. Chairman Johnson, Representative Saylor, that's a very good question, and it's a little bit of both. And we'll get into that. The argument that I'll make is that broadband throughout Greater Minnesota, throughout rural Minnesota, is really quite widespread. But it's not ubiquitous. It's not everywhere. It's in most places. And it's certainly spread out in rural Minnesota to a greater extent than it is rural parts in other states. But to argue that it's ubiquitous is not really true. And quite frankly, even if 99% of rural Minnesota had broadband, if you happen to live in that 1%, well then, you know, it's still not available to you. This next slide really looks at these three characteristics over time for Greater Minnesota. And this is really the crux of understanding how adoption is taking place and is going to take place. If you really look at this, this top blue line represents computer ownership. And you can play around with, oh, it's going up, it's up, going down. You have to understand these are statewide surveys. There's always a margin of error in any kind of survey. And so the reality is that computer ownership in Greater Minnesota is fairly flat. It probably is, you know, and it's ticked up a little bit this past year, but it really hasn't moved that much. I mean, in 2003 it was 65%, and in 2006 it's 66%. I would argue that in 2006, if you didn't have a computer in your home, there is a very high probability you're not going to have one in your home in 2007 either. And that's just the reality. It doesn't mean that people aren't purchasing new computers in 2007, but they're purchasing new computers to replace old computers. And people who don't have a computer in their home today, unless something drives them to it, are not quite likely to have it next year either. Now, the good news is you see that internet connectivity mirrors computer ownership. This really means the overwhelming majority of people who have a computer in their home have it connected to the internet. Approximately 90%. And so in terms of internet connectivity, it really mirrors computer ownership in our homes. Broadband adoption is a very different story. And as you can see, the pace of broadband adoption in greater Minnesota has been linear, and as you can see, it's been accelerating. If you really look from 2001, 2002, 3, 4, 5, and whatnot, you can basically pick out that it's been increasing by about 6 percentage points a year in a fairly steady fashion until this year, where we saw it go from 27% to almost 40%. Now remember, at the beginning of the presentation, I talked about when you get to around 30% of the population adopting a technology, you start getting to that point of the curve where it really starts shooting up. And I would argue we are at that point in the adoption curve where the demand is being driven, and in a little bit I'm going to talk about what I believe is really driving that demand in a way that's going to continue for a while. This looks at technology adoption rates, these same three parameters, by region. And essentially, for your information, northern Minnesota is defined as people who have an area code of 218. Really is that simple. Central Minnesota is if you have an area code of 320, or if you're outside the seven counties, 763. Because there are some 763 area codes outside of the seven county metro. And southern Minnesota is basically area code 507 or outside the metro 952 and 651. For example, communities like Wabasha have a 651 area code. And so there are some areas that are outside seven county metro that have metro sounding exchanges, if you will. So that's how we define these regions. Interestingly enough, we're finding that things have really evened out across the regions. That wasn't true years ago. Years ago, northern Minnesota was lagging quite considerably behind central Minnesota and southern Minnesota. But now we're starting to see things even up quite a bit. And it is kind of almost paradoxical that southern Minnesota seems to have the lowest concentration or diffusion of computers, but the highest of broadband. And if I would guess, bear in mind, this does include Rochester as southern Minnesota. So that could be, you know, part of that explanation. To understand the adoption of these technologies, availability is certainly part of it, but you can't get away from demographics and socioeconomics. And we've been seeing this for a long time. This looks at the impact of age on the adoption of these technologies, both inside the Seven County Metro and outside the Seven County Metro. And not surprisingly, while the actual levels are different, the pattern is precisely the same. Age matters. It's just that simple. And basically, the older we are, the less likely we are to adopt these technologies. And what we see is the exact same pattern with income. The lower income you have, the less likely you are to adopt these technologies. And part of the differences, going back to Representative Saylor's question, is part of the differences that we see between the metro area and greater Minnesota is simply that greater Minnesota has a higher percentage of elderly people and a higher percentage of lower income people. And it really is just that simple. And you can't get away from that fact. We've been studying these things for years, and we see the exact same pattern year after year. It's true in the metro area, and it's true in the non-metro area. Age and income matters. And so trying to find the immediate fix to get lower income people and seniors to adopt this technology, good luck. You know, We really haven't seen much movement. As much as people talked about years ago, but grandma and grandpa will be able to see digital pictures of their grandkids from Florida, and they'll rush to this technology. It made sense. It was a great line. But unfortunately, it's just not true. We just don't really see any evidence of that. That doesn't mean that there aren't seniors that adopt this technology, but nowhere near at the rates that younger people do. Now, the good news in all this, when you think about it, is that the issue of age is going to fix itself. There's nothing I can do to convince my mother at 88 years old to adopt this technology.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Schmanz.
Garofalo.
Thanks. When you say that age is going to take care of this, does it, are you saying that people who don't adopt technology are going to die?
Chairman Johnson, Representative Garofalo, we're all going to die. And somewhere in the back of all of our heads, we've kind of come to accommodate that reality. But the point I'm really trying to make is that I'm assuming that you are, like I am, reasonably computer and technology savvy. And I would also argue that when you move into your senior years, you're not all of a sudden going to lose your computer skills. You're going to be able to take them with you into your senior years, and so will the rest of us. And so as we start moving, if you think of it as a continuum from young people to older people, and we're somewhere in the middle, some of us closer to one side, some of us closer to the other, as we all start moving and aging, if we have computer skills today, we're going to be able to take them into our senior years. So over time, it will take care of itself. That is not true for low-income people. You know, even the Bible tells us the poor will always be among us. And so trying to figure out how to get lower income people to adopt this technology is an interesting policy question. But I would argue that for the obvious reasons, age will take care of itself. Income will not. Not surprisingly, both in rural areas and metro areas, we ask people, regardless of whether they have dial-up or broadband, are you satisfied with your connection speed? As much as people might tell you that they need, 100 megs per second or 5 million megs per second, truth is there's a fair amount of satisfaction with speed as it relates to broadband users today. And actually, I think that what we're finding is that satisfaction rates are actually increasing. We've typically found broadband satisfaction rates being lower than this, and this is the first year where we've seen satisfaction rates kicking up. But it's only been recently that broadband providers have been offering speeds as fast as maybe, 6 megs per second to residential customers. So that might have something to do with it. On the other hand, dial-up customers are becoming increasingly dissatisfied. And it used to be that the satisfaction speeds for dial-up customers were actually higher, but they're really becoming more and more dissatisfied now. So for those who represent providers in the room, I suspect what's happening is, quite frankly, especially for telephone companies, because telephone companies are really the only providers that are still dealing with these dual technologies. You know, the other providers don't offer dial-up. I think they're trying to more aggressively kick people off dial-up now. I think they understand that maintaining these dual technologies is really a waste of time. One is really fading out. There's higher income on the broadband side. Prices are coming down a little, and they're trying to do their best to move people off dial-up because, maintaining these new technologies is just, kind of a waste. this is really something that I think, this next slide, you got to wrap your head around. When we talk about buying broadband, understand the majority of people today do not just buy a broadband connection. They buy it from a provider who's offering them a package or what the providers call a bundle of services. And that's good. People view that as value. So your cable provider will offer you this kind of basic and these premium channels and this speed for one kind of package price. Same thing with telephone providers. You know, they'll offer you, you know, these class of services, this long distance package, and DSL at these speeds for one package price. And obviously, consumers are buying it for a lot of reasons. They don't need three bills. They get one bill, and that's good. And they perceive it to be a value. For researchers, it's a pain to have these bundles because, you know, I'm assuming that just about everybody in this room who has broadband at home likewise purchases it in some kind of bundle. And so when I ask you, how much do you pay for your broadband, the truth of the matter is you really don't know. And I really don't know either. You know what the providers are telling you you're paying, but, you know, if you buy these premium channels, you can get broadband for this amount. If you only buy this package of video services, well, then broadband will cost you a different number. If you buy these class of telephone services, your broadband will cost you that number. So how much does broadband cost? Well, if I don't know and you don't know, you just know there's one price for a package and you see that as valuable, that's all you really need to know. But trying to figure out whether or not prices and costs of broadband are going up or down is not that easy because so few people are buying it as a standalone product anymore. And this whole idea of people purchasing their broadband in a bundle has a lot of implications for lots of other policy issues, especially as we start talking about, you know, municipal entry into broadband and internet, public services going on to the internet, more public services moving online. Because for most people, you're not just talking about getting their broadband in a different way. Now you're also talking about getting their telephony and their video services in a different way. And is that where you really want to go? Or what does it all mean? It makes for interesting policy that we can talk about a little later on. But understand, the point I'm trying to make with this slide is simply that most people just don't buy a broadband connection. They buy a package of entertainment services and telephony services, and broadband is part of that. To go directly to Representative Saylor's question regarding why people who have dial-up connections say, I don't want to adopt broadband, there are multiple reasons. These are the most common. Most common, year after year, always the case, it's just too expensive. Whatever they perceive as expensive, it's too expensive. And there's kind of this strange phenomena, because we also ask people, and I don't have a slide for it, who have dial-up, well, what would it take? How low does it have to go? And years ago, they would say, well, you know, it has to be below $30 a month. And then it started being, well, it has to be $25 a month. Then it has to be $21 a month. And actually, you would think the switch price, the price in which people would say, yeah, I'll jump, would actually go up as they find more value on broadband. But it's actually going down. And the reason why it's going down is that the people who said years ago, well, if it got around 30, I'd jump, they jumped. So they're now broadband providers, they're broadband users. And then when it started kind of creeping down, and there are some providers that are offering, you know, an entry-level broadband as low as $26.95 a month now. those people jump. So the people who are left with dial-up are fairly hardcore dial-up users, and they're not really interested in paying a whole lot more for broadband than what they're paying for their dial-up connection right now. So the switch price each year continues to go down as the people who are ready to jump actually jump. And so we might have to wrap our heads around the fact that until telephone providers say, we're not going to offer dial-up anymore, and if you want your internet, you're going to get it that way, there may just always be a group of hardcore dial-up users who are just not going to switch for a variety of reasons. The second most common reason is actually makes a lot of sense. People say, you know, I don't really use the internet very much, and I just don't use it enough to justify the added cost of broadband connection. Maybe they just use it to email their kids or their friends or whatnot. And email is email. It's no different on a dial-up connection and a broadband connection. It's email. You write a text, you send it off, it comes back anywhere between a couple of minutes and a couple of days later, you know? And so, you know, that's logical. And then, of course, the last is there are people who say, well, it's just not available. As I said,
question here, Dr. Geller from Representative Wall.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Geller, when they talk about not available, and you may have been about to get to this point, were you able to measure whether it was truly not available or they understood it was not available?
Right. Chairman Johnson, Representative Morrow, that really is the crux of the matter. And the truth of the matter is, depending upon how you define it, for example, the rural co-ops have launched Wild Blue, a satellite service with a footprint over all of Minnesota. So with that alone, you can argue that it's available everywhere. It may not be affordable to you, and that's a price issue, but you could certainly make the argument it's available everywhere. It doesn't mean that it's marketed in your area, and it doesn't mean that you're aware of it. So ultimately, these responses suffer from the same problems that all self-reported surveys suffer from. People know what they know and they don't know what they don't know. And so when they say it's not available, what they're really saying is, I don't know that it's available to me. Now, in some cases, other studies we've done have shown that it truly is not available. If you live in a municipality within the municipal borders of a community in Minnesota, there is an extraordinarily high chance, you know, that you have access to at least one broadband provider, a DSL provider, cable provider, a fixed wireless provider. There's somebody there who almost overwhelmingly is providing it. If you live outside the municipal boundaries, it gets a lot dicier, and it depends upon how far. Most cable companies have their franchise agreements within the municipal boundaries, and they don't go very far out beyond that. Some go a little bit out into neighboring townships, but really not very far. Same thing with DSL providers. DSL providers are much more likely to push further out because they have technology that allows them to push further out. Some might go a mile or two or three outside the municipal boundaries. Some might go quite a ways outside. But it's really depending upon the particular provider you have. And then you add fixed wireless and you add satellite providers. So to answer your question directly, yes, you're absolutely right. This is people's awareness of what's available and not available. And the majority of time that it's not available, it's because you live outside the municipal boundaries of a city or town in Minnesota. I was just chatting just 2 days ago to Representative Otremba, who lives 2 miles outside of Long Prairie. And she said, well, she can't, it's not available where she is. And I believe her in the sense that I'm sure that there isn't the DSL provider, I believe Sprint in Long Prairie, or the cable company that's going to go out to her rural location. She could get Wild Blue from some electric co-op, but she's in Minnesota Power's territory. So she's not being served by an electric co-op. So chances are, while she can go to a neighboring co-op and get it, and there are some other providers who are not co-ops who are reselling Wild Blue, most likely not in her area. Doesn't mean she couldn't get it, but she'd really have to work hard to be able to get it. So from her perspective, it's unavailable. And it's also interesting to note that a lot of people think this is a rural Minnesota problem, and it is, but let's not forget there are parts of western Hennepin County where people live outside the municipal boundaries on their 2, 3, 5, 10-acre farm with a few horses and, you know, whatever. And some of those people are dealing with the very same issues that we are. And whether it's in, you know, the South Metro or the West Metro, there are some people who are living outside the municipal towns and boundaries that are experiencing it in the metro area. When I was testifying on a totally different issue in front of Representative Otremba's committee, Representative Junkie asked me about wireless and cell phones and whatnot. We do have some information on that, so I thought I'd provide it to you, though it's a little bit off track. As you can see, cell phones are pretty widespread in both rural and metro areas. About 73% of households in the rural areas and 78% in the metro area report having at least one cell phone. Bear in mind, 10 years from now, there will still be a percentage of the population that don't have a cell phone, you know. And so that's just the nature of technology adoption. We also asked, do you ever send and receive text messages with your cell phone? And as you can see, it's a little bit more common in the metro area than it is in rural Minnesota. We also asked, do you have a phone where you can take pictures and send it to friends and neighbors and whatnot? And it's about, you know, twice as more likely residents in the metro engage in that behavior than in rural Minnesota. And then we also asked, do you have a laptop computer that can connect wirelessly to the internet? And as you can see, it's twice as more likely, actually more than twice as likely, in the metro area for that to occur. Again, when you start talking about innovations and what is mainstream, it really wasn't too many years ago. If you were walking down the street and there were a few tables set up in front of Starbucks or Dunn Brothers or Caribou and somebody had a laptop and they were on the internet, it would stop you. And you'd go, that's pretty cool. That's really neat. Today, you know, you wouldn't get down the block if you stopped every time you saw that. This behavior is really quite mainstream. But let's remember, you know, 4 years ago, it was a fairly uncommon thing, you know. And then the last thing we looked at were various different kinds of handheld devices. I called it BlackBerry, but it wouldn't have to be BlackBerry. Any kind of handheld device that allows you to send and receive email was actually the question. And as you can see in that case, it is far more likely that metro area residents engage in this technology than in rural Minnesota. Now, let me talk a little bit about what I think is driving this demand and why we're at this point of the curve, and then we'll kind of close it out, and whatever questions you might have, we can engage in that conversation. Clearly, both in rural and metro areas, broadband providers are spending a whole lot more time on the internet than dial-up users, I should say. Now, when you think about it, years ago, and I've been making these presentations for quite a number of years, I used to go in front of people and look at online behavior, and I would basically make the argument that people who have a broadband connection are doing the exact same things that people with dial-up connections are doing. The only difference is they're doing it faster and more conveniently, which would make the argument if that were true, that they could spend less time on the Internet because they're just doing it faster. But clearly, while that was true a few years ago, that's not true at all today. And what we're seeing is we are seeing content providers developing applications only for broadband users. The dial-up users are locked out of these kinds of things. And that's what's driving the demand. The utilization of newer applications that are really only meaningful to broadband providers. And if you want to engage in these kinds of activities, you're going to make that switch. This gives you just a simple idea of what I'm talking about. When you look at email, doesn't matter in the rural area or the metro area, just about everybody who has an internet connection emails at approximately at the same rate. You know, and it's true for dial-up users, it's true for broadband users, it's true in rural areas, it's true in metro areas. Okay? Because quite frankly, email is email. And it was, if you recall a few years ago, deemed the killer application. That people were going to the internet because they wanted email. And so the search was on amongst content providers for years to find the next killer app. What would be the next killer application that would be as ubiquitous as email, that would drive people to broadband? Well, I would argue that there is no application that's a killer application in exactly the same way email was. But what you found is a culmination of a number of applications that were designed for broadband users that collectively have become the killer application. Best example, and we really start seeing the drive in this, it started with Napster, where people were able to start moving large files, mostly music, across the internet very fast. And then things really popped when Apple came out with iTunes. People don't understand iTunes is about as close to a killer app as we have now. And all the other iTunes-like kind of applications. It didn't take long that once people started really adopting broadband and being able to move large music files.
Dr. Geller, I think Representative Hilty has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Geller, looking at the reported online activity, it seems to me there's a very important category that's missing here. Am I the only one that uses online connectivity to search for information? I mean, mm-hmm. I think Google has become, you know, as a verb, a very common word in language, but there isn't any indication here that people are using their computers to find information.
Chairman Johnson, Representative Hilty, when we write the report, we actually have about 24 different activities that will be in the report. And everything from researching medical information, which is extremely common. Probably the next most common thing, interestingly enough, aside from email, is checking the weather. You'd be surprised how many people check the weather, you know, online, researching and buying things online. I mean, there's just a wide range of other activities. The reason why I picked these for this particular presentation was what I wanted to do was show how certain applications are really being driven by broadband. People who have dial-up Google every bit as much as people with broadband, you know, and the search for information or checking the weather is a very common thing for everybody, dial-up or broadband. But what I tried to do is find those applications that really we saw huge differences in between broadband users and dial-up users, And these are the kind of applications that are actually driving people to broadband. Things like researching the price of a new car is very important, and people do it. But they do it with a dial-up connection at closely to the same rates they do a broadband connection.
Representative Moore has a question, Dr. Geller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Geller, on this reported online activity, I'm taking it as a snapshot as opposed to longitudinal information. Do you have longitudinal data, for example, on the work from home? Are more people in rural Minnesota telecommuting now?
Chairman Johnson, Representative Morrow, yes, we do. Only for greater Minnesota, though. Actually, what happened is we started doing these rural Internet studies back in 2001, so we have about 6 years of data. And whenever we would publish the information, people would say, this is great. How does it compare to the metro? And, of course, our answer was, we don't know. Nobody's collecting it at the metro. We're the only ones who are doing it in rural Minnesota. So last year, in 2005, was the first year we said, we have to answer this question. And so we started collecting data in the metro area, and we collected it again, in this most recent survey. But 2 points a time, as you know, in the metro area, doesn't really make much of a trend line. But we do have it for greater Minnesota in terms of almost all of these categories. As you can see, as we started going from Napster to iTunes to now YouTube, where we're able to stream video, these are applications that really demand a broadband connection. And now the latest iteration, I don't know, does anybody subscribe to Vongo or know what Vongo is? Okay. Well, you know, this is an application, and you're going to see it's quite common. It started out with places like Blockbuster that would rent you a video cassette. And then Blockbuster started renting you a DVD. Then Netflix got in the game, and you can start ordering your DVDs online. Vongo is a service where if you have a broadband connection, you just immediately download the movie and stream it, right to your computer or widescreen TV or whatever technology you're using. No need to order anything, and wait for it to come in the mail or run down. It's just going to download onto your monitor. Now, the interesting thing is people say, well, yeah, but I don't want to watch a full-length movie on a video screen. Understand that if you have a widescreen TV, I got in my home, and you might have in yours, a 50-inch flat-screen TV. Beautiful picture. And it is a TV. It basically is a monitor, and it has a little tuner in it. So if I hook it up to a cable connection, I can, change channels. But the truth of the matter is, my tuner is idle. It's set on channel 3, and it hasn't moved in years. Because I have a digital set-top box that my cable provider gives me. And that's really my tuner. And so that set-top box or that satellite set-top that you get from your satellite provider is actually changing the channels on your TV, and your tuner that's in your TV is really just sitting idle. Well, the consequence of that is most of us have that now. Not all of us, but most of us do. And so it didn't take long for people in the video industry to realize that we don't have to put tuners in these things. We could just make 50-inch monitors, and people will hook it up in different ways, and you can watch that downloaded movie streaming to your big screen monitor, if you want to call it, or a TV, or whatever it might be. The point is that these are technologies that if you live in the dial-up world, you're locked out. And increasingly, that's the kind of technology that's driving people to broadband. There is no one killer app in that sense. If there was, maybe iTunes has come about as close as anybody, in my opinion. But it really is the culmination of all these things, and virtually all the applications that are being developed today are really being developed with the assumption that there's a broadband connection on the other side. Now, The other thing that we're starting to see is public policymakers like yourselves are more and more interested in driving a variety of public services online. And so you're able to, you know, the construction worker or the guy who owns the construction company doesn't have to run down to the courthouse to get his permits for the day or for the week. Just from home, go online and get those permits. And you can buy your car tabs, if it's secure now, online as well. And the overwhelming majority of people who are engaged in commerce are paying their quarterly sales taxes to the government and reporting them online. And more and more and more, you're seeing public services being driven online. And I would argue that's a good thing. But it's going to drive more and more people online, and public policymakers are going to have to pay attention more and more to how do we going to offer these services to people who, for whatever reason, are not online, or how do we enable them to get online. And I would argue that it won't be that much longer, as scary as it may seem, that we're going to start seeing some pilots, if you want to think of it that way, of people voting online. And the way you're going to engage in your democracy is potentially with an online connection. And I would argue that probably maybe the most logical first stop on that would be something like absentee voting, you know, where you can actually vote. If you don't happen to be on election day in the county that you're supposed to vote. And it's not a bad way to think about what the first experiment might actually be. Now, yes, I know there's security issues and all those things, and it's really scary, and it's really scary to me too. But I just have absolutely no doubt that at some point in time, maybe not as soon as I think it's going to happen, we're going to start seeing that to the point where the way the majority of us will actually engage in the democratic process, the way we will engage our public officials, might in fact be online as well. And that's going to drive people in addition. And I believe this may be the last slide I have. When we talk about being a kids game, it really is a kids game. This looks at broadband adoption just simply depending upon whether or not you have kids in your home. And actually, this was school-age kids. So we asked people, do you have kids in your household between the ages of 6 and 18? And you can see that rural or metro, kids are driving this train. And they will continue to. They are a big part of the Internet. Broadband is being driven by entertainment, probably more than anything else, but it's also a really increasingly important tool for commerce. And just a quick example, if you're Anderson Fabrics up in Black Duck, thank you. These folks are remarkable. I mean, I used to live in northwest Minnesota up in Grand Forks area, and actually went to Anderson Windows and or Anderson Fabrics and had them make our home curtains. But that's a small part of what these folks do. Think about all the bedspreads on every hotel bed in America. Think about the curtains and all that stuff. When all of a sudden places like Marriott Hotels or Hilton Hotels tell their suppliers, you know, if you want to be in our procurement catalog, we're moving it all online. And so the way we're going to work with our suppliers on the one hand and our customers on the other hand is going to be electronic. The Internet is not only for our entertainment, it's an important tool for commerce, and it's an increasingly important tool in the delivery of public services as well. And so this is a train that's moving. And I would argue, as the adoption, as we are at that point on the adoption curve, where we're really starting to see things almost move vertically, if there is such a thing as a tipping point, we're probably either at it or, in fact, might actually be past it, where the services and the activity are really going to drive the demand itself. Few quick points. At least the way it stands right now, that slow growth in home computers is going to likely provide an upper ceiling at the household level. Metro areas continue to outpace rural areas in technology adoption, but understand that it's not just because it's more available or necessarily cheaper. Demographics and socioeconomics have a lot to do with it. Truth is, we just have a lot more elderly people and lower income people in rural Minnesota, and that's driving a lot of the differences, in addition to availability. The most cited reason why dial-up customers don't adopt broadband is still price. But as I said, the bundling of services has really helped a lot in driving the demand, but it makes it hard to figure out in terms of price comparisons. When you're talking about price, and if I ask this person how much they pay for their internet, and they say in our town, we get broadband for $35 a month, and in this town, the average is $40 a month, does it necessarily mean that that town has more expensive broadband? I don't really know. And the reason why is that price might be tied to what kind of bundle of other entertainment services they purchase, and understand that most providers now are pricing based upon tiers, based upon speed. So, if these folks are purchasing 6 megs per second and these folks are purchasing 1 meg per second, that might explain the price difference, and it doesn't necessarily mean that broadband is more expensive somewhere else. Availability is not the primary barrier to adoption, but it is still a barrier in some parts of rural Minnesota. Product differentiation is increasing vastly. And what I mean by that is, as I said, years ago, we would see people doing the exact same things that they're doing with a broadband connection that they did with a dial-up connection, only faster and more convenient. Today, they're doing fundamentally different things with a broadband connection that you can't do with a dial-up connection. I would argue right now, today, the consequences of being on the wrong side of the digital divide is somewhat modest, you know. And when we call people and they say they don't have broadband or they don't have, you know, and they go, it's not for me, you know. And they believe that. And that's okay, you know. I mean, it's not for everybody. And the consequences of being on that wrong side of the digital divide is, you know, so you can't download movies. Big deal, you know. Or you can't do this, you can't do that. But increasingly, as more and more public services, more and more commercial services, more and more activity is driven to the internet with a broadband connection, the consequences of being on the wrong side of the digital divide will become more significant. So while I would argue they're modest today, we have to understand that we're dealing with tomorrow. And because of that, it's going to force people like yourselves, policymakers, to think more carefully about this. And what does it all mean, and how is it going to impact the delivery of public services? What does it mean for people who are on the wrong side of the digital divide, oftentimes unintentionally? And so I guess maybe I bring that to your attention, because oftentimes it is the unintended consequences that are the most difficult to deal with, not the ones that manifest themselves obviously. I believe that's the end of my presentation, and I'd be happy to take any questions or comments about this work we've been doing for 6 years now.
Thank you very much, Dr. Geller, and Members will certainly take questions for Dr. Geller at this point, if anybody wants to offer any up. Representative Szymanski.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Geller, I just would like to thank you for the, you know, the study that you've done, you know, really looking into the heart and soul of Minnesota and finding out, you know, what's important, you know, throughout the state. And I commend the your organization for going through those efforts and really supporting all of rural Minnesota.
Chairman Johnson, Representative Szymanski, I appreciate those kind words. And as I said at the very beginning of the presentation, the center was established by the Minnesota State Legislature to really serve as a resource to policymakers, not just rural policymakers, but to policymakers to understand what's going on in rural Minnesota, whether it happens to be in telecommunications, rural education, economic development, and a number of other areas, and we'll continue to do our best to do that.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Geller, I do appreciate the information, too. It's very good stuff every year that you generate out of there, and hopefully we keep funding that to a level that provides this. I guess the one comment I'd have is, and maybe it's a policy issue at some point, and it was your reference to Representative Otremba, I can also reference my roommate, Representative Rukavina. Until about 2 weeks ago, he complained because he only had dial-up service. But someone from his home area told him, I think similar to what you were saying, no, there's a line-of-sight tower available now out in your area in Pike Township, north of Virginia, and you should be able to access that tower and get, you know, $250 to put the dish in and $45 a month or something. You should be able to have high-speed Internet. He had no idea. So, again, we're talking about two legislators that have no idea services available. How do we get that out? I mean, we have our small telecom people. We have our co-ops out there. But, again, they're not advertising across their, obviously, across their service territory at this point in time for the most part, or I think both of those folks would have known about it. Is there a role for government to play on that, whether it's Department of Commerce or others, providing lists, at least a listing by county of service providers available and in what areas it's available, so that somehow, you know, I hate to say to go to the Internet to find it because not everyone obviously can do that, but somehow, you know, with a phone call or a some way to say, gee, so when someone says, you know, I don't think I have Internet, you can say, no, call this number. Right. They will tell you whether you have high speed available or not, and through who, and here's who you contact. Is that a simple public policy thing that we should be looking at?
Dr. Geller, Chairman Johnson, Representative Junkie, it's an interesting question, and my answer may depress you a little. Understand that while we're all kind of looking at the evolution of this technology, providers are in their own evolution as well. And not to be hard on them, the reality is that, especially on the telephone side, but generally, these are regulated industries. When you're a regulated industry, it's a little bit different ballgame, you know, historically. For example, when you moved to Wilmer, and I don't know if you're a homeboy or not, you know, but when you moved to Wilmer as a young person, if you did, chances are you said, I need a telephone. And you know what? You didn't turn on TV waiting for the telephone company to advertise, here's where we are. You had to go find the telephone company. And we do that whenever we move, you know, because regulated industries, by and large, that have regulated service areas, and you can think of it as regulated monopolies if you want to, really didn't have to have much of a marketing budget. And that's the history of those industries. The Internet, for all providers, is not regulated. But it doesn't mean that people don't necessarily, you know, all of a sudden jump out of their historical ways of doing things. And so even though this particular product is not regulated and they are in a competitive environment, you know, you do see a lot of providers all the way around being a little bit slow on the marketing side. And I give providers a certain amount of slack, understanding that historically in their industry, there really hasn't been much of a need to market. But it's all changing now. And what you're finding is that there are no lists, as you're talking about. I was in Washington a few months ago speaking to the administrator of the Rural Utility Service. And they handle the rural electric side, and they also handle, you know, broadband. And they were complaining that there is, as strange as it may seem, the Rural Utility Service does not have a list of here are all the communities in the United States that have broadband. Such a list does not exist. So if the federal government doesn't have it, you know, and they're really, you know, since it's not regulated the way telephones are, and people can just kind of put up fixed wireless sites wherever they are, and when you put up a fixed site, a wireless site, what exactly is your territory? I don't know, you know. I mean, a provider might say, well, we serve this community. But it might be on the very furthest fringe of their reach with their wireless technology. You know, on a good day in the wintertime and the wind's blowing in the right direction, there's no leaves on the trees, we can hit that place, you know. But are you really servicing it? You know, there's no standards for these kinds of things. So such a list does not exist. And then, you know, we've made attempts over the years to occasionally try to do that. It's not that easy. It can be done. And I don't think, I can't speak for, and I wouldn't even try to speak for providers, because I'm not one. I don't think the providers would have any big problems with you, meaning government, having a list, you know. But it sounds like it would be easy to do. It really isn't as easy as you think.
I think Representative Sale, you have a question, too?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Geller. I'm just interested in what you may have learned in talking with businesses about people working from home. Mm-hmm. When I looked at the slide of having less of that occurring in rural areas, which I understand, I mean, that kind of follows along with the general trend. But when looking at how technology applications could help out with, for instance, energy, and looking at the distances people have to drive with high gas prices, and thinking in a rural area, it would certainly make sense to be able to have more people work at home. I'm just wondering what you may have heard from business with regard to that, and, you know, what are barriers for having those sorts of opportunities in rural areas?
Yeah. Chairman Johnson, Representative Saylor, a lot of it is tied to what exactly your work is. And in those who work in some sense in the information industry, and that could be a teacher, an accountant, you know, it's not necessarily just limited to people who are, you know, kind of high tech folks and programmers, but people who don't physically use equipment on the job, but rather are knowledge workers. They most likely do work from home in rural areas, maybe close to the same extent that they do in the metro area. The problem is we just don't have as many knowledge jobs, and I'll use that term in a very broad sense. Could be a college professor, could be, like I say, an accountant, could be any number of professions. Attorneys are routinely doing research from home and whatnot. But the industrial mix of knowledge workers and non-knowledge workers, if that's even a word, is different in rural areas. So, again, that will always you know, create a ceiling. Most people who work from home for an employer are not permanently telecommuting. You know, they may be doing some work for their employer in the evenings or stay home a half a day and do some stuff. You know, the telecommuting that we typically or maybe stereotypically think of the housewife working from home in a bathrobe and bunny slippers on, you know, with an internet connection, really doesn't exist to any great extent. Those things do occur, but most people who are working for an employer at home still have an office at the office, wherever it may be. But they're just doing some work at home. And people who do that just have a much easier time doing it when they have a broadband connection. And so you see some very large differences. But I suspect that the rural or urban differences really are more a function of the industrial mix of their workplace.
Thank you very much, Dr. Geller. I think that exhausts today's questions. I really appreciate the report that you gave us today. Can we expect more information on this? That
yes, Chairman Johnson. When the report comes out, and I'm figuring probably 30 to 45 days, as we do with all our reports, all legislators get copies of everything we do. And I should mention that for those who are interested, the next issue of the Rural Minnesota Journal will be coming out on, I believe, the second week of March, and it is all about health care in rural Minnesota, a really good issue. So I look forward to either putting it in your hands or putting it in your mailbox in a few weeks.
Thank you very much. You do not seem to be a laggard. we may or may not be meeting next week. Check your email on that. We do have a bill coming up the week after that. Representative Mason's cell phone contract bills will be taking a look at that at that time. We're still trying to get someone to give us some information about what's going on the national level, since it impacts what's occurring here on the state level, and we'll keep you posted on that as well. And if you have any other ideas, let me or Ms. Emerson here know, and we'll take a look at it. But thank you much for your time today, and we'll see you later. Meeting adjourned.